She won't ask for it.
And before we get started, a big thank you, of course, to Royal Bank of Canada and everyone here at the Bodleian Libraries. I've had such a wonderful stay. Everyone has been so welcoming. And especially to Alex Franklin at the Visiting Scholar Center. In 1867, Eliza Lynn Linton, a journalist, lamented a new trend appearing on the streets of English cities: the overt use of beauty goods to enhance women's appearances. To her dismay, the trend wasn't relegated to elite and middling women. Linton charged that inexpensive beauty goods were being taken up and used by even the rather disreputable and poor to manipulate their appearance through beauty routines. She documented the use of pearl powder, violet powder, rouge, beast for the eyelids, belladonna for the eyes, white lead and black lead, yellow dye, and mineral acids for the hair. And she didn't even begin to consider those goods available to men. To make matters worse, the offending commercial wares had a foreign taint. For Linton, fashionable consumption of foreign-sounding goods like blanc marimont powder and Egyptian coal amounted to a rejection of middle-class English norms. Goods included, quote, huge nests of coarse hair shorn from some Russian or North German peasant girl, which meant that the lady goes forth looking much more as if she had stepped out of the green room of a theater or from a Haymarket saloon than from an English home. Besides sexualizing women, powder, paint, and hair pieces erased social distinctions and possessed dangerous democratizing effects. Physical appearance, once a clear indicator of class difference, had now become an unreliable social marker. Linton claimed that it was, quote, difficult now for even a practiced eye to distinguish the high-born maiden or matron of Belgravia from the anonymous who haunt the drive and fill our streets. Linton wasn't alone in her admonishments. A survey of Victorian didactic guides, medical literature, and print commentary reveals widespread condemnation of artificial beautification. Indeed, commentators like Linton expected English women to come by their beauty honestly. They implored women to adhere to a natural aesthetic, imitative of Queen Victoria, and decidedly unlike their foreign sisters in America and France, where overt beautification was more acceptable. And yet, critiques of artificial beautification often appeared alongside effusive celebrations of the attractive female form. Beauty, of course, being a sign of overall health, and perhaps more importantly, reproductive capabilities. So despite criticisms of artificial aids, this veneration of beauty meant that many English women and men took up techniques to enhance their looks, mixing complex chemical compounds at home or purchasing goods from a growing range of urban traders. The goal, of course, was to evoke a natural look, so as to align with dominant ideals regulating bourgeois respectability. It's for this reason that women's quest for beauty in Victorian England was culturally and nationally distinct in its emphasis on discreet and subtle interventions. For the most part, Linton and her contemporaries directed their contempt at female consumers who tainted their natural beauty with paint and powder. In doing so, critics overlooked the growing body of tradespeople, men and women, who made possible these trends, the beauty practitioners who helped the girl of the period to dye her hair and paint her face. In fact, beauty traders played an increasingly significant role through the Victorian period in women's attempts to enhance their appearance. So today I'll be using materials from the John Johnson collection of printed ephemera, as well as beauty manuals from the Bodleian collections, to reassess traders' roles in reforming 19th century English beauty culture. Specifically, we'll look at marketing techniques employed by a vibrant community of commercial beauty traders operating through the 19th century. How did English traders navigate public censure of beautifying practices and publicize their contentious wares? How did marketing strategies align with or diverge from dominant social mores, regulating female self-fashioning? Today, we'll track the role of Victorian beauty brokers in engendering a growing tolerance of beautifying goods and practices through the century. Resounding public criticism of beauty practices shaped the ways that traders advertised their wares. By the fin de siècle, beauty providers had definitively established the respectability of certain goods and aided in revising a culture that had once equated beautification with artificiality, or even worse, outright deception. Until the late 1850s, there was no formal capitalist beauty industry in England, and especially not one catering to female clientele. Through the 18th century, London had developed a substantial perfumery business based on trade skill and craftsmanship, which was patronized by the men and women of the nation's prosperous mercantile and aristocratic classes. Their patronage reflected expanding urban markets and commodities, but also new cultural and aesthetic associations relating to whiteness and English identity. So according to scholar Kim Hall's analysis of early modern literary and cultural productions, the early years of European colonization generated a racialized hierarchy of lightness over darkness. The subsequent idealization of fairness imbued women's complexions with symbolic functions related to moral purity as well as social and racial hegemony. These powerful new connotations expanded public interest in beautification beyond the elite and urban consuming classes. Medical and domestic recipe books corroborate middling men and women's practice of what scholar Edith Snook has termed beautifying physic. Home production lasted into the 19th century, when some women relied on time-honored recipes and compounds to enhance the quality of their skin, hair, and nails. And so this text is from the collection here at the Bodleian. And you can see it's from a mid-19th century home recipe book. And I don't know if it's legible, but we have a recipe for pomatum for the hair, hair wash, and then antidote for any poison, and then whooping cough. So you can see there's this mixture of beautifying goods and health goods. These types of recipes typically meant eschewing the overt paints targeted by anti-cosmetic satires in favor of things like cleansing washes and complexion creams that were manifestly a component of medical practice. Home beauty production was tolerated as part of a longer tradition of domestic recipes and exchange, but only just. Through the first half of the 19th century, new conceptions of bourgeois femininity consolidated linkages between physical beauty and woman's moral purity. Romantic and emerging evangelical domestic ideologies prescribed an idealized femininity in which a woman's physical appearance conveyed the seasons of a woman's life or her connections to the natural world. Before long, a domesticated femininity defined by authenticity and artlessness, emerged as the desirable form for a bourgeois wife. Pamphlets and didactic health literature subsequently deplored female cosmetic use as reflected of women's duplicitous inner character. Meanwhile, toilet books condemned unnatural artifice while simultaneously detailing complex recipes and beauty techniques. For example, one handbook of the toilet instructed female readers how to dye the eyelashes using a strong aqueous solution of carbonate of soda applied by means of a fine camel hair pencil. Meanwhile, 1858's Art of Beauty suggested using a piece of leather and pitch plaster to tear off superfluous hair. Middle-class women's magazines, new cultural forms flourishing in the 1850s and 1860s, also reinforced the rejection of artifice in lieu of honesty about one's physical appearance. However, there existed a tension in the very pages of the texts. On the one hand, critics and authors derided artificial beautification. On the other, these same middle-class sources identified beauty as an important indicator of mental and reproductive health, qualities central to women's perceived success on the Victorian marriage market. print censure subsequently couldn't dissuade upper and middle class women from engaging in discreet practices of bodily self-fashioning to attain an effect of what scholar Amy Montz has termed artificial naturalness. Correspondence columns of leading periodicals like the English Woman's Domestic Magazine betray evidence of these efforts, as female correspondents disclosed highly private aesthetic concerns to an imagined community of readers. So in this textual forum, women negotiated the level of risk involved in conforming to popular fashions of clear, unblemished complexions and full-bodied hair. So readers inquired, for example, how to cure little pimples on the forehead and chin, while others solicited the opinion of correspondents on different depilatories for that pesky unwanted hair. Others requested advice on more distressing developments. So in one case, for example, two large patches on a correspondent's head had become completely bare from wearing fake heavy curls that had actually pulled the hair out. So she inquired in this correspondence column for help as to how to regenerate hair growth. Tensions between authenticity and artifice intensified in the late 1850s when the development of aniline dyes produced new varieties of brightly colored textiles. England's middle and upper class women excitedly transformed vibrant mauve, magenta, even neon green fabrics into the latest French fashions. Very unhealthy, these neon green fabrics, incidentally. According to scholars, showier forms of dress in turn engendered a renewed interest in cosmetics use. While a natural aesthetic remained the fashion through the 1860s, new technologies in making up and a growing sensitivity to beautifying goods suddenly increased the visibility of artificial embellishment. So indeed, it was this shift that inspired Linton to issue that scathing critique that opened this talk. The woman of artifice dramatically figured in other literary productions from the time, including sensationalized, serialized novels like Mary Elizabeth Braddon's Lady Audley's Secret from 1862 and Wilkie Collins' Armadale from 1866. Now, contrary to these sensational accounts of female self-fashioning, most middle and upper class women stayed true to discreet measures to enact a natural, unadulterated aesthetic in an effort to avoid criticism. This included the adoption of a new crop of beauty products that eliminated gray hairs, whitened discolored teeth, and produced a blemish-free complexion like an English rose. From the mid-century, coverage of beauty issues in health manuals and periodical publications began to betray early influences of a commodified consumer culture. Indeed, while self-production perpetuated through the mid-19th century, ladies' magazines especially began to promote the purchase of beauty goods rather than their production at home, a shift engendered by a growing commercial market for consumable beauty goods. So in 1865, for example, the English Woman's Domestic Magazine launched a new column called The Silkworm Spinnings, which featured a female author who traveled from shop to shop and chattily recommended the latest goods and services. Her endorsements included some of London's leading perfumers and hairdressers, who were gradually making a name for themselves on the national scene. So who were these English commercial providers who, from the mid-19th century, facilitated the purchase rather than the home production of beautifying goods? And where did female shoppers buy the washes, powders, soaps, and dentifrices increasingly featured in the pages of their favorite ladies' magazines? A consumer's class status and geographic location determined the appropriate venue for beauty consumption. London's West End was unquestionably the heart of England's commercial beauty culture, with its complementary associations of luxury services and elite patronage. There, ladies looking for beautification typically applied to a perfumer, an imprecise category that could describe manufacturing perfumers, but also at times hairdressers and wig makers, or the enigmatic category of beauty consultant. In London's retail perfumery shops, tradesmen like Eugene Rimmel, Septimus Piès, and Francis Henry Breidenbach manufactured a new scent every year, alongside an expanding array of face powders, eye pencils, rouge for the face, and colored cosmetiques for the hair, which was an oily stick that you would rub in your hair to cover grays. Other high-end commercial retailers, including hairdressers and peruke makers, stocked similar goods while also providing services in hair cutting, but also hair singeing, where they would actually burn the end of your hair to reduce its length. Skin and nail care also fell under the purview of perfumers and hairdressers, but it wouldn't be until the fin de siècle that traders self-identified as manicurists, starting in 1891, and complexion specialists, starting in 1904. So as you can see here from this this column from the Times in 1858, there's a variety of products that are available for both genders. So we've got Breidenbach at the top with his new wood violet scent, all the way down to Mrs. Hedman, who ran a modest shop for women where she helped them to dye their hair. The industry was enhanced by the growing respectability of perfumers and hairdressers from the 1860s. As traders increasingly aligned themselves with professionalized bodies in the chemical and manufacturing trades. This shift was bolstered through the 1870s and 1880s when advances in wholesale and industrial manufacturing reconfigured the scale and organization of the industry, mostly to the detriment of small-scale entrepreneurs and many women, but that's another story. Many well-known retailers, manufacturers, and wholesalers, like the aforementioned Eugène Ramel and Charles Yardley, sought to confirm an expert designation, like their professional rivals in the chemical and medical sciences. So beginning in 1883, for example, a contingent of perfumers sat on the London Chamber of Commerce's chemical trade sections under the category of chemical manufacturers. Across England, perfumers and hairdressers established trade organizations, presented findings at prestigious scientific societies, and generally promoted a respectable trade profile that countered ongoing distrust of their goods. Despite their efforts, it was not until the final years of the 19th century and the rise of the new woman, as we'll see in a moment, that there emerged a growing acceptance of the visibly made up. As we'll see, this shift was engendered in part by women's growing public role as white-collar workers, political interlocutors, and shoppers. But it was also due to the efforts of England's perfumers and hairdressers, who through the 19th century worked to revise public attitudes through a range of publicity stunts and marketing developments. Popular opprobrium of beauty practices through much of the 19th century forced beauty advertisers to develop innovative marketing strategies to sell their contentious wares. One of the most notable features of Victorian beauty publicity is the presence, or lack thereof, of female subjects in their advertisements, not to mention their actions, that is to say what the subjects are doing or aren't doing. A number of factors informed beauty retailers' use of the female subject to hawk their wares. 19th century gender conventions, and especially dominant conceptions of bourgeois feminine respectability, discouraged the depiction of women in beauty ads, let alone female subjects engaging in overt beauty practices. Print technologies and fiscal limitations further limited possibilities available to Victorian beauty promoters. And yet, an overview, a survey of the female subject as it appeared in Victorian beauty advertising, reveals slowly shifting normative values around beauty, self-fashioning, and cosmetics through the 19th century. As we'll see, women were increasingly central to marketing campaigns, yet there were limits on the modes of representation and activities of these particular subjects. So in the early years of Victorian advertising, it wasn't difficult for beauty traders to conform to social conventions regulating depictions of the female form and female self-fashioning. Most early advertisements, beauty or otherwise, were almost exclusively text-based. Through the 1830s and 1840s, print conventions and technologies meant that advertisements entailed long, often dense product descriptions. Trade cards and handbills like these acted as cataloged listings of goods available from small urban shop fronts, as well as commercial agents stationed in provincial outposts. The abolition of England's advertising duty in 1853 expanded the number of beauty retailers listing wares and services, most often via pretty modest advertisements in the popular periodical press. As in the early century, however, ads were succinct, text-heavy, and rarely featured embellishment, let alone images, elaborate images. While there were certainly limitations to the style, it also meant that advertisers could avoid referring to who actually used these products and allows them to skirt the boundaries of respectability. It also meant that some smaller providers, including women, could actually compete with larger competitors through print advertising campaigns. While it remained prohibitively expensive for large segments of the commercial population to place newspaper ads, small-scale traders could use discreet ads to publicize their beauty services to the literate public. While a handful of early Victorian beauty traders developed modest print campaigns, there was one marketing innovator who, from very early on, launched exceptionally elaborate marketing schemes, outperforming competitors from across the Victorian commercial landscape. Alexander Rowland of Rowland's Macassar Oil fame. Macassar Oil was one of England's most popular commercial hair products into the 20th century, when it was finally eclipsed by other, more benign washes and tonics. The oil is most often attributed to Rowland, but it was actually manufactured by a number of different traders who concocted their own unique versions of Macassar. It typically consisted of a perfumed essence combined with some kind of oil or fat. So later incarnations tended to feature palm oil, but earlier products typically featured bear grease or more often pig suet to achieve the ideal levels of oily sheen. Used by both men and women, the product is most often remembered for affecting the severe slicked style of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when trendsetters and local customers made popular that timeless sort of drowned cat look. Rowland's domination of the Victorian commercial landscape was due in large part to his ambitious marketing innovations, or as his critics would characterize it, his incredible onslaught of puffery. From 1810, Rowland launched a marketing assault on England's literate population, simply inundating a range of readerships with print advertisements. In some of the earliest examples of marketing hyperbole, Rowland promised that his oil, remembering what it is, that it's pig fat, that his oil could eradicate impurities, cure baldness, prevent hair falling out, cover grays, produce curl, and induce a transcendent, beautiful luster. And all of this from the same bottle. Customers happily trusted these promises, and by the 1840s, Rowland's became only the second firm in England to advertise a product nationally, and not just beauty firm, second firm in all of England. By 1855, the Quarterly Review reported that he spent the incredible sum of some £10,000 per annum on promoting his famous oil. The advertisements proved pervasive into the early 20th century, appearing everywhere from domestic manuals to the racing news to Debrett's Peerage. One form of advertising that Rowland perhaps did not appreciate was the incredible popularity through the 1870s and 1880s of anti-macassars in Victorian homes. Across England, housewives and domestic servants drew attention to effects not typically advertised in Rowland's ads, namely oily stains left by macassar oil on the back of family furniture. So we can see here a living room with a couple of anti-macassars that people would crochet to counter the effects of this oily hair product. As I said, these never appeared in his ads. While the sheer volume and breadth of Rowland's campaigns were exceptional, the general form of his ads were not. Like other mid-century advertisers, Rowland's publicity campaigns relied on text-heavy copy, replete with glowing testimonials, product descriptions, and, of course, unreasonable promises. Unlike other advertisers, however, Rowland was careful to market his product to all types of consumers, young, old, men, women. In this way, Rowland buoyed his reputation and no doubt enhanced his profitability by marketing his product to everyone. thereby avoiding any sort of moral challenges over female beauty consumption and respectability. Indeed, solitary women didn't appear in Macassar advertisements until the late 19th century, by which time there was a growing acceptance of overt female consumption of these types of products. First out the gate, Rowland was soon joined by a growing contingent of commercial advertisers who staked their claim in the burgeoning beauty business. Their efforts were enhanced by new innovations in marketing, dating from the early 1850s, when dramatic advances in commercial advertising meant a move towards the colorful billboards and handbills that we most often associate with the Victorians. These advances occurred in large part because of the Great Exhibition of 1851. Scholar Thomas Richard has argued that the exhibition was a watershed moment in the history of English marketing, that when a group of advertisers placed themselves, quote, at the exact juncture of commerce and culture, and so became the minstrels of capitalism, end quote. It was from this moment that traders undertook what Richard terms a spectacularization of advertising, which, over the next 30 years, ushered in a modern era of English commodity culture. This shift apparently originated in the exhibition, which from May through October 1851 captivated the nation with its industrial wares and technological marvels. It was also a platform from which national interests advertised their country's resources and economic visibility and viability through the display of commodity forms aimed at a new mass public. Included in these wares were beautifying goods, soaps, perfumes, essences, and limited cosmetics. Displayed in class 29, miscellaneous manufacturers and small wares. In this way, beauty traders were implicated in the new visual and commodity cultures emerging out of the exhibition from the earliest moment. Beauty goods classification as an official manufacturing class in the exhibition simultaneously bolstered perfumers' connections to the respectable manufacturing and chemical sciences. This distanced industry players from rumors of shady backroom operations where mysterious beautifying processes were purportedly performed on vulnerable female clients. So I've just pointed out there, I mean, there are a variety of different perfumers listed, but the first three are Rowland, who we just met, Yardley of Yardley fame, and Eugene Rimmel, who we're gonna return to in a minute. Or Rimmel, I should say. The embodiment of the beauty industry's new professionalized status was, not coincidentally, also one of the breakout stars of the exhibition. So, our old friend, French-born perfumer Eugene Rimmel, operated a modest shop out of London's Francophone enclave in Soho, where he lived and worked. The scale of his operations transformed, however, following his triumph at the Crystal Palace, where he installed an elaborate perfume fountain that issued eau de cologne via decorative fonts. Located in the Transept Gallery, Rimmel's display booth attracted thousands of visitors, including the Queen herself, who reportedly dipped her handkerchief, gloves, even her hands in the scent fountain for cooling and perfuming apartments, etc. The open display of Rimmel's novelty encouraged its consumption by all types of visitor. It could even be said that it democratized an expensive, inaccessible luxury item. Indeed, for many working class visitors, the exhibit would have represented the first tactile experience with these beautifying commodities. Rimmel rode the wave of his 1851 triumph, dominating England's perfumery trades for the next 30 years through an adept combination of product development, branding, and publicity. Having secured his public status as a respectable man of industry, he also challenged advertising conventions and became one of the first beauty business people to foreground female subjects in advertisements. However, given the enduring criticism of overt female beautification, he didn't depict women in the act of buying or using goods. Rather, Rimmel's famed perfumed almanacs, which have been covered in some blog posts from the Bodleian by your own Julianne Lambert, featured female pictorial representations relating to popular themes in art, literature, and science. produced annually from his factory on the Strand in London. He published such titles as The Language of Flowers in 1859, The Four Seasons in 1866, and Heroines of Italian Poets in 1873. Rendered in a florid style, the chromolithographs' exotic decorative elements underscored very Western narratives of modernity and industrial progress. They functioned as vivid, brightly colored advertisements for Rommel's feature products, all while promoting Victorian discourses of femininity and, of course, natural beauty. Rommel's particular mode of beauty was not only natural, but decidedly English. Explicitly nationalist tones come to the fore in select almanacs produced between 1861 and 1871. Specifically, the 1863 edition featured female representatives of his European continental competitors. National allegories played on stereotypes relating to climate, culture, and natural physical features. Each of the six European nations were represented by a two-month season, a flower, and an affective quality. So here, for example, we have German wildflowers, which depicted simplicity, while the autumn was devoted to Spain and its elegance. Pictorial descriptions of Russia, France, and Turkey rounded out the group. Significantly, each female allegory shares very similar facial characteristics, with the exception of coloring. This was most explicit in the case of women from Turkey and Spain, whose dark hair and eyes contrasted the lighter pigmentation of their northern European representatives. Notably, the fairest and blondest of the feminine figures was England. She was the embodiment of beauty and was adorned by a rose and no obvious artificial manipulation. England's flaxen ringlets gleamed as bright as her scepter, outshining even those of her Germanic cousins to the east. By upholding a dichotomy between the domestic and the foreign, Rommel endorsed a type of national feminine authenticity. England's clear alabaster skin and lightly colored cheeks were strikingly unusual in their perfection. But rather than depict women being made up, the almanac's organization implicitly signaled the likelihood that beauty could be achieved by participating in Victorian commodity culture. So the trade list that followed detailed cosmetic goods that weren't meant to dramatically alter a female consumer's appearance, but that would help her achieve a natural English aesthetic. So it's difficult to read, but on the left-hand side, we've got a variety of perfumes listed. And on the right-hand side here, he lists such goods as toilet waters, pomades, cosmetic washes like Rommel's lotion, and glycerin paste, rose leaf powder, toilet soaps, dentifrices. So Rommel's juxtaposition of nature and artifice promoted this artificial naturalness that on the surface didn't challenge Victorian values of authentic English identity. In this way, Rommel's advertisements underpinned the fact that natural beauty was a construct. Like nationality, it could be learned and was increasingly achievable through the use of discrete commercial goods. Despite Rommel's initiatives, expectations of discretion continue to dominate beauty advertising. This was the case even after the rise of wholesaling and the desegregation of tasks allowed individual shopkeepers to devote more time to developing publicity campaigns. Taking their cue from Rommel, increasingly capitalized wholesalers, like London's Robert Hovenden, who's listed down here at the bottom, developed their own discreet marketing campaigns to hawk the latest beautifying wares. Like Rommel, Hovenden promoted a refined and restrained version of femininity in his print advertisements, showcasing female figures that are not actively engaging in beautification. Indeed, in one 1868 ad for Rossiter's Hair Restore, there's absolutely nothing to indicate in the image that the good would alter a woman's appearance. In fact, based on the image alone, it's entirely unclear what the product looked like or how it was used. Rather, Hovenden's advertising scheme circulated visual representations of secrecy, sharing, and female homosocial bonding. So as we can see, the 1868 ad depicts two female confidants conferring around a large bottle of Rossiter's Hair Restorer right there. Presumably, the owner of the hair tonic, the dark, long-haired figure on the right, she prefers a single flower to her female companion. The fairer, if not plainer, recipient reaches out in response to grasp the flower, a representation of not only the secret to the patron's beauty, but also the naturalness of her methods. "It is not a dye," reads the accompanying text, which also reassures middle-class consumers that it's the cheapest and best restorative hair around. A homely female-centered image, the advertisement again embodies an aesthetic of artificial naturalness. What's more, its basis as a connection between friends downplays the presence of Hovenden and a new set of commercial actors. In this way, the tradesman inserted himself and his goods into an intimate domestic interaction, albeit in this case via a trade press that was really for other wholesalers and traders. Hovenden was the leading wholesaler in England's mid-century beauty business, with his carefully curated advertising and goods. By the 1880s, however, his tasteful advertising techniques had been usurped by more brazen, direct forms of publicity, including those that depicted women in some acts of self-fashioning. The growing presence of active female subjects in advertising wasn't relegated to the beauty industry, and was related in part to the expansion of women's public roles from the 1880s onwards. As historians like Judith Walkowitz and Erica Rappaport have noted, the period saw a growing visibility of women in public space, with their dramatically enhanced roles as notable philanthropists, political actors, and of course, workers in the white-collar trades, retailing, and the service sector. Women's new public visibility was also heightened by their role as consumers, shoppers, increasingly courted by retailers, and a new brand of trader known as the universal provider. Early department store magnates lured female customers not only via a range of goods, but also through the construction of urban commercial pleasure zones designed specifically to accommodate polite feminine sensibilities. So department stores like Whitley's and Bayswater created new, safe, sanitized space for female customers, furnished with wallpaper tea rooms and lavatories. Major retailers realized the pecuniary benefits of accommodating a new form of mobile urban shopper, namely ladies who arrived with pocketbooks in hand. Traders in England's beauty business closely monitored these trends, subsequently adopting a bolder beauty aesthetic to align with women's increasing mobility and public presence. New beauty manufacturing companies, with their catchy trademarks and goods, played off the freedom embodied by the new women of the 1890s. This archetype figured prominently in gendered advertising, the femme de siècle, characterized by her pursuit of an active public life through work and education, not to mention her healthy, mobile body. Of course, the new woman who attended rallies and zipped around town on her bicycle also required a clear complexion and bountiful hair to signal her vitality and zest. Emboldened by new cultural attention to healthy female form, some femme de siècle advertisers designed extravagant campaigns touting effects that bordered on farce. Prominent new companies like Coco Maricopas and Capsuloid depicted not only female figures, but those with, for example, unnaturally long and lustrous hair. Such advertisements typify a handful of particularly bombastic campaigns at the femme de siècle. This group took up and expanded on growing attention to the female form to promote a mode of extreme beauty, in which qualities associated with natural beauty, like long hair and healthy skin, were amplified to the point of spectacle. No case better illustrates this than that of Reuben Goldstein Edwards, who touted his hair tonic, Harleen, via multiple vividly colored publicity campaigns. From 1883, Edwards ushered in a new trend in advertising in which the hair, and specifically women's hair, was fetishized as a gendered signifier, but also as a commodity. Hair had long been an essential and profitable element of the Victorian beauty culture. So I mean, just to give us an idea of the scale of the Victorian hair trade, in 1851, English traders reportedly imported some 11,000 pounds of raw hair from France to serve the market. From the 1880s onwards, companies like Edwards and Coco Maricopas took advertising trips to new levels in the display and objectification of this very long, beautiful, bountiful hair. In other ads, Edwards evoked long-standing traditions in conceptualizing beauty by linking this long, lustrous hair to our healthy reproductive body. Through his regular depiction of mothers and daughters ritually grooming their hair in the privacy of the boudoir. In this ad, the female subject's vanity takes a backseat to her maternal instincts, and her focus is drawn away from her reflection towards her child. The healthy subject grooms her flowing locks, all while modeling self-fashioning practices to the next generation of curious female consumer. As in earlier advertisements for Rimmel and Hovenden, there are no visible acts of purchasing or using the product. The message is not one of commercial transaction. Rather, the use of Edwards Harleen is implied as an offstage act that precipitates this incredible hair growth of which we as future customers bear witness. As in the case of Roland, these bombastic advertising campaigns for Edwards grossly overstated the efficacy of the goods. So in 1812, the British Medical Association did a chemical analysis of Coco Maricopas and found that it was 94% water, 3% alcohol, 2% glycerin, with scant traces of borax, formaldehyde, and perfume. So really, not enough to make up for these types of transformations. It was really just a bottle of expensive water. Markedly restrained by comparison, another mode of publicity at the fin de siècle took up cultural forms specific to the era, namely the cult of the celebrity. Through the late 1880s and 1890s, female actresses and stage performers increasingly emerged as household names, courting popular followings via burgeoning fan culture. Leading beauty advertisers capitalized on this shift in popular culture, enlisting increasingly influential actors and singers to publicly endorse their goods. So this is an example of an American company, Menin. You know, we all know the jingle, the by Menin. This is them in their English ads. And this is from left to right, the different actresses and singers who are depicted. Celebrity endorsements featured an instantly recognizable female subject with widespread cultural cachet, but one whose cosmetic use was actually necessitated by her work on the stage. Actresses like Ellen Terry undoubtedly employed creams and cosmetics as part of her craft. So for advertisers, there was no need to imply the use of the goods on sale. At the same time, the hiring of celebrity sponsors, and specifically women of the theater, represented a marked change from just 20 years earlier, when beauty advertisers' reliance on actress sponsors would have been a risky venture. In the mid-19th century, unfavorable rumors circulated about the use of cosmetics by actresses, not to mention their purported moral laxity and periodic dabbling in casual prostitution. Because remember, Eliza Linton, in the critique that opened this talk, criticized women who looked that they were coming forth from a green room, like an actress. Fin de siècle transformations in reputations of both actresses and beautification is subsequently remarkable. In just 20 years, two previously maligned trades united to turn a significant profit off of the beauty desires of a female consuming public. Actresses were not the only women taking advantage of the cult of celebrity and the innovative technologies in self-fashioning that emerged at the fin de siècle. Also mobilizing techniques in discrete self-promotion and commercial identity was a new wave of small-scale female entrepreneurs, beauty culturalists, who were at the forefront of shifting cultural norms around beautification. Traders like Mrs. Jeanette Pomeroy and Mrs. Anna Rupert publicized their attractive urban boutiques where they sold personal lines of toilet preparations and skin foods, offered manicure services, and even removed superfluous hair and moles via a new technology known as electrolysis. Rather than depict the recipients of these services, however, advertisements focused on the beauty culturalists themselves, whose refined appearance and careful repose confirmed the efficacy of their beauty systems, not to mention their calm confidence in their skill. Supplementary print campaigns supported claims that beauty culturalists were, quote, honest women who would candidly tell their sister women the truth about their complexions, end quote. Women's purported role as female confidants and arbiters of taste allowed beauty culturalists to broach sensitive topics. Advertising price lists confirmed that intimate bodily services no longer denoted indecency as it had for their mid-century predecessors. Another key marketing strategy adopted by beauty culturalists was the foregrounding of the space in which these services transpired. Indeed, depictions of commercial facilities bolstered traders' images as purveyors of feminine secrets. As one laudatory article described, women's beauty shops offered a perfumed atmosphere, the implements of silver and ivory gleaming amongst the paper packets tied with pale-tinted ribbons, expressing the frivolities feminine in this bower. However, beauty providers weren't merely enticing women with these silver and pink implements. In describing their commercial premises, beauty providers were promoting transparency between specialist and client, inviting and empowering potential customers with their frank descriptions of the services and the spaces in which they occurred. Beauty providers like Jeanette Pomeroy and Anna Rupert capitalized on dissatisfaction with impersonal mass-produced goods to offer new artisanal boutique services like manicure, complexion care, and electrolysis. As in Hovenden's mid-century advertising, their advertisements appealed to an idealized femininity based on intimacy and trust. And yet, like their forebears, beauty culturalists resisted depicting the consumption of beautifying goods and services. Even in an era of growing transparency in female consumption, images of female beautification were rare and carried the risk of public censure. It would not be until the explosion of color cosmetics in the interwar period that practices of beautification could appear unproblematically in the popular marketing campaigns. So, to conclude, what can we learn from studying beauty advertisements in a period often characterized as bereft of beauty practices? And what role did a burgeoning commercial culture play in transforming sociocultural expectations of female self-fashioning? As we've seen, slowly shifting values around beauty practices and manipulation of the female body derive from a number of interrelated factors, commercial and otherwise. Material and technological advances in print, a growing commercial beauty industry bolstered by advances in mass manufacturing, national aesthetics promoting a particular mode of white English beauty, as well as women's new public roles in the last decades of the 19th century. By charting the development of ads over time, an argument can be made for the ways that beauty advertisers not only follow trends, but periodically advance them, disseminating images of a consuming female body to Victorian England's literate populations. As we've seen, this was a slow and calculated task in which female subjects often played fleeting or limited roles. Prolific advertising campaigns from the likes of Rimmel, Hovenden, and Edwards guardedly depicted the female subject, albeit not one engaging in acts of beautification. However, by the end of the Victorian period, we see female entrepreneurs controlling the messages conveyed in beauty advertising, offering a more delicate, refined vision of female beautification, but one in which women were firmly in charge. Beauty marketing campaigns would expand exponentially with the next generation of commercial beauty leaders, many of whom we know and love today. For example, Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden launched beauty salons in 1908 and 1922 in London, respectively, from where they led the charge for a 20th century embrace of beautification. This next generation encouraged women to be their most beautiful selves and depicted women taking measures to do just that. Because of the enthusiasm with which 20th century consumers adopted new color cosmetics, it's often to this period that we attribute the greatest shifts in popular conceptions of femininity and beautification. However, we mustn't overlook the Victorian predecessors to the entrepreneurial greats whose names and brands endure to this day. In this way, contemporary beauty moguls were the successors to, rather than the sole innovators of, modern beauty marketing. Thank you.